You know what's missing on the back of my book?
What's that?
A barcode.
Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your host, Jorn Sutai Vampyr, and Jajim Vestai Jajim will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am Judge Im.
I am Jorn.
And today we are going to be looking at a book called World Without End by Joe Haldeman, published in February 1979.
This book is so early in the Star Trek book series, it does not even have a number. It is the new Star Trek experience.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So don't expect a lot of deep thought here, guys. It's just, let's see if this concept of writing Star Trek novels even works beyond what James Blish did with the novelization of the episodes.
Mm-hmm. And you have a note here about the publication dates.
Yeah, it's like 30 years. This book was written, was published about exactly 30 years before, earlier than, the last book that we just did last month.
Yeah, and that last one was A Singular Destiny by Keith R.A. DeCandido.
Back in February of 09. I can do that now. Because everybody knows it's not going to be 1909.
So we've got a lot of years of Star Trek books. So
not that many of them.
Yeah. So anyway, World Without End. Why don't you give us a brief summary of the plot?
This is like the shortest editor's description of the novel. Chatala, a fantastic artificial world inhabited by furry winged creatures with awesome powers. Here, Kirk, Spock, and their Enterprise mates, trapped, face terrifying death. And if by some miracle they escape, they will confront the roving killers of the dread Klingon Empire. And if you're waiting for more, there ain't any.
That's it, huh? Wow.
That's it. That's what the back of the book has. It has like 3/4 of the back of the book white.
Oh, wow.
No words on it, just white.
Yeah. Well, let's continue on with the overall impressions. I'll go ahead and start this one. So, we have a space vessel disguised as an asteroid. Where have we heard that one before?
Actually, you've got here listed the Star Trek episode.
Yes.
That they did it. But that's not the first one. Oh, no. That's not the first one. Robert A. Heinlein did Orphans of the Sky, which is the same basic idea.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It's such a basic idea and such an interesting idea that David Gerard wrote a teleplay for Star Trek that was going to be a 2-part episode doing the same thing.
Uh-huh.
A spaceship traveling through the stars, who the inhabitants of the spaceship, which is a generation ship in this case, people grow, die, reproduction brings more people in, and it never got made. For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, that one finally got made.
Mm-hmm.
I think David Gerard wrote in his book on Star Trek that apparently the special effects for his story would have been too high for the series, which is, again, one of the reasons he tried to split it into 2 episodes to try and spread out the cost.
Did you mean David Gerald?
Yeah, David Gerald.
Okay.
What'd I say?
Gerard. But
no, Gerald.
You know,
a triple guy.
Yeah. Well, so this, that was For the World Is Hollow and I've Touched the Sky is original series, season 3, episode 10. And only we're not dealing with the Fabrini this time, and it's not the world of Yanada. In spite of the similarities to the TOS episode mentioned, there's nothing else in the book that is familiar as a really good Trek story. I mean, our characters are pretty accurate, but other than that, I found it difficult to get through. It's also, I think I would call it a failed Klingon story. We don't get a whole lot of Klingon stuff there. It's kind of a stock baddies kind of an episode for the Klingons, or book for the Klingons. And there was an introduction of a thing called the Nova Bomb, which is supposed to be the most powerful weapon ever, and the Klingons have it. And nowhere else have I ever heard of that weapon. So,
and you probably never will again either.
Yeah.
Because remember, in Star Trek 3, they're looking for the ultimate weapon that the Federation has come up with, you know, where they can destroy whole planets.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, this book is written in the 70s, and basically had a book coming out in the 50s, and a movie made of it in 59, where the Q bomb or quadridium bomb was developed as a uber doomsday device like the Nova bomb. And I'm sure that was sitting in the back of his mind, because The Mouse That Roared is a very entertaining movie. It's another one of those where you've got Peter Sellers playing, God, maybe four different roles in the movie.
Huh.
But yeah, this ultimate doomsday bomb was floating around as a thingy back then.
Well, that being said, for me at least, the overall story was not all that great. You know, and seriously, I would have expected much better from Joe Haldeman. So, those are my...
Well, the problem I think here is Joe may have been forced by the editors, by the publishers of this series, into the choices that he made. This is actually his second book. In fact, if you go to the afterword that Joe has at the end of this book, he's pitching a contest for people to go through his earlier book and find the mistake he made. And he's offered some sort of prize for the first person to find the mistake. But the contest ends in December of 1979. So there's no point in us trying to go out and find it and do anything with it. So, but, you know, he may have been constrained by what the publishers wanted in a book. It may have been, give me as much as you can, episodic Star Trek.
Yes. So your overall impressions?
Basically, Joe was told by his editor to give him as close as he could to episodic Star Trek. Okay, I threw in another thing of the Prime Directive, all right? Is the Prime Directive coming into play anywhere in this story? Kirk lets his team get captured too easily, and their weapons fall into the enemy's hands to the point that somebody is playing with it and explodes one of the phasers.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, in trouble because they killed some of the inhabitants of the planet that are going to get killed anyway and have to be sent replacements for, because they may have looked at the phaser and they weren't supposed to do that. No, but the Federation is not worrying about the Prime Directive anywhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you've got a star-faring civilization. And here I'm talking about the Federation, or the Klingons, or the Romulans, any of them. And they've got a rogue dark planet floating through the galaxy. And at the time, near light speed.
Mm-hmm.
Not exceeding light speed, but near light speed. It's slowing down through the course of the novel, but that's a navigational hazard. Somebody should have charted it.
Yeah.
Somebody should have figured out its trajectory. Somebody should have marked it on the maps, especially since the Klingons lost a ship to it.
Yes.
There is a Klingon ship crashed on the planet, on the planetoid.
Yeah.
I think. I'm not sure. I thought there were times I was getting the impression that the Klingon ship was inside the asteroid.
Yeah. No, I think it was on the surface. So
yeah, that would make sense.
I don't know. We've got the story. Let's just talk about the story. The Enterprise encounters a magnetic field that disables all the systems on board. And you know, they're tracking a hollow asteroid being used as what they assume is a generational transport. They do an analysis of this object and find that there are life forms on board who have been in flight for something like 3,000 years, and they come from a system that went nova. Okay, so, you know, we still have the similarities to the TOS episode. Now, Kirk and a team beam aboard the asteroid, and they startle the locals that are there, and they are taken into custody and have a hearing of sorts to determine who the landing party are, and the locals call them...
No. They know who the landing party is. They're Klingons.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. They're called Klingons. Also magicians.
Because Klingons have landed before and done nasty things to the people.
Yes, we have a different strain of Klingons is what they're assuming. Okay. So we've got a lot of similarities to a TV episode developing here. It's very quickly developed. Now, the inhabitants of this world, the Chatalians, are described as being furry winged creatures, and they have a definite caste system.
A locked-in caste system.
Yeah, and it's to the point where one group cannot even communicate with another group.
They've got different languages.
Yeah. It sounds like a very complicated hierarchy in this society inside this asteroid.
At least until we get to the end of the story, then you can see why that is the case.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike, how the hell was the Enterprise detecting life in the planet, in the asteroid, if life in the asteroid is not animal-based?
Right. And, you know, the funny thing, too, is they were able to beam aboard the asteroid, but something was stopping the Enterprise from beaming anybody back.
And what they never tried was sending pattern enhancers down to the planet to try and beam them back. Because there have been situations in Star Trek where you can beam down, but you can't get back. When you're beaming down, you've got all of the transporter technology literally at your feet. But beaming back, you got to rely on the ship's technology to do its thing and get you back. So they came up with pattern enhancers.
Now, I don't remember. Did they have pattern enhancers on original series? Because I don't recall.
I don't know.
I don't recall them on that. Now, they had them in Next Generation. But I don't ever recall hearing or having them mention those in original series Trek. I guess I'll have to look that up.
I don't think they did, but it's something Scotty would have, or Spock would have thought, we need to do something to boost the signal, or why is it? Because they were assuming that if they could put a pinhole, just a pinhole through the hull of the asteroid, they could beam people back and forth.
Yeah. And I think it was the material that the asteroid was made out of that was the big problem.
But if that was the case, sending them either way should have been a problem.
Mm-hmm. Now, following the asteroid, the Enterprise discovers the wreckage of an old Klingon ship on the asteroid. They actually beam down on the asteroid, almost lose a crewman while they're doing this. I think Sulu's leading the party. And they do access a log entry describing their encounters with the natives and how they died on this Klingon ship. Apparently, yes. So we're mistakenly calling the humans Klingons because apparently these people have never met anything other than Klingons outside of their own race.
And if they heard the word Klingon, they may associate that with anything that is not of their species. Remember, or for those of you who don't know, there are no Vikings. Viking is what the Norse countries did in medieval times, not who they were.
Mm-hmm.
If they were going on a raiding party, they were off Viking.
Okay.
Well, that was the term they would throw out to the populations who they were raiding. So they would immediately assume that all the Norse people coming into their area to loot and raid and yada, 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 were Vikings.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So in other words, the word Klingon is synonymous with...
just mean...
with alien.
Animal being.
Alien, yeah. Not of us. Okay?
Not of us, yeah.
Right. So now, the next thing we have happening is there is a huge energy drain on the Enterprise. So they are having to take measures to conserve energy. Back down on the asteroid, or in the asteroid, a magician appears. And this is what they apparently call the people who are authorized to talk to aliens. They call them magicians. And Kirk and company are called Klingons and have returned to wreak havoc. And in actuality, the magician seems more like a Klingon, more likely a Klingon, you know. Spock, he joins the landing party and is threatened, and they escape confinement. They're confined, and then they escape to seek a place, to seek the place where the magicians live in order to appeal their case and be allowed to leave again.
And that thing with Spock threw me for a loop.
Mm-hmm.
Spock was not part of the original landing party. He was told to stay on the ship.
Yeah.
And just all of a sudden, out of the blue, our logical Mr. Spock beams down to save everybody.
Yeah, and winds up being trapped.
Spock, he'll save every one of us.
Yep, and he's trapped with everybody else. Well, there's a little bit of a journey going on. There's a river, and on the other side of the river, there is a jungle with mutants that are hostile. And this is where we get a big battle where there's a lot of killing. And we also learn that the salt from human bodies cause pain to the natives.
And that concept needs a whole lot more explanation.
Yeah.
In my opinion. Because even plant cells have saline solutions inside of them.
Yeah.
It's the ability of salt to lose and gain electrons that allows most living structures to, well, do the chemistry they need to do to survive.
Right.
Pure water is not really all that great for living systems.
No. Yeah, there's no electrolytes in there to transfer messages. At any rate, let's just say that the Chitalia's biochemistry is way different than human biochemistry. But Spock was able to touch them and not cause them pain. It was only humans and the salt in our skin, in our chemistry, that caused problems. So the Enterprise is still having an energy drain, and Scotty is starting to get a little bit nervous.
I think Scotty was getting nervous before Kirk left. It's Scotty. And
yeah, well,
something's happening to his engines. And Therefore, he's nervous.
Yeah. So Spock sends out a distress signal. Okay, how he manages to do this is, you know, I'm sure quite ingenious. It gets intercepted by a Klingon ship called the Khorezima, a weird Klingon name. It starts with a K, though. I guess that makes it okay. And
if we look at the Klingons that are named in the book, they also start with a K.
Yes, everything is with a K. We have Captain Kulan and his first officer, Kahl. All right. So what do the Klingons do? They immediately launch what they call a Nova Bomb to destroy the asteroid and send a signal warning the Enterprise to get out of the area because this thing is coming and there's no stopping it.
Well, they send a signal to the Enterprise that it's coming to kind of cover themselves so the Organians don't think they're attacking.
Yes. Again, we get the Organian treaty brought up again. But now, Scotty, this is something that really bothered me. Okay, Scotty orders preparations be made to abandon ship. Okay, where the heck are they going to go?
It wasn't the first time that had come up. They had been talking about if the power drain gets too much, they were going to have to go inside the asteroid for life support because the ship was going to be uninhabitable.
Yes. Well, the Nova Bomb is on its way, so supposedly the asteroid is going to be uninhabitable as well. So, oh boy, we're going to abandon ship. Where are we going to go? Well, Kirk steps in and says, oh no, you're not. You're going to stay there. You're going to hunker down, and 430 some odd people will be just fine. And Kirk and company continue their journey looking for the magicians. And Scotty is trying to make a plan to stop the Nova Bomb, which is unstoppable.
Well, remember at this point, Scotty doesn't know it's unstoppable.
Right. Now, Scotty disobeys orders, basically, and goes ahead and transports the crew, the entire crew of the Enterprise, into the asteroid. And he stays behind because he's going to stop the Nova Bomb. And what he does doesn't work. And he winds up having a big party with Captain Kulan from the Klingon ship.
Who beams in to gloat.
Yes, he beams in to gloat, and they wind up, he's stuck because he can't beam back, and he and Scotty have quite a little party. They talk a lot, they drink a lot, but that was, of course, only because they needed the drink to stay warm. Kirk, back down on the asteroid, Kirk's team is attacked. But they do manage to get the upper hand, and they reach the island and make the magician take them to a place where the machines are, is how they put it. The Chitalians, they say, where the machines are. There's some substance when they arrive that drains their weapons. They've got no way to defend themselves.
What kind of bothered me, though, about all this, and it's getting to the end of the story that it really perturbs me.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about the other life forms on the planet. And I don't mean the mutants, because we get an explanation on them, but where do the eels come from?
Yeah, and what was that about?
Yeah, well, they were only there to prevent the Enterprise people from swimming or wading across the earlier river, mm-hmm. lake, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But I think that would have required a longer novel, and I'm pretty sure Bantam Books had put a page limit on Joe.
Yeah. I think this might be explained as we go on, okay? The Klingons are very confused. They don't understand why their bomb doesn't work when it arrives. Apparently, the dampening effect from the asteroid stopped it from detonating. On the asteroid, Kirk learns the nature of the natives' technology. Spock finds his father, or they find this father machine. And Spock, of course, jumps right in and mind melds with it. We find out that it is the only sentient being on the asteroid, that all of the other beings there, the Chitalia, the eels, the mutants, were all just creations by this father machine for entertainment.
In fact, wasn't there a scene earlier where Spock tries to mind meld with the translator and there ain't anything there?
Mm-hmm.
It's just blank.
Right. So the Klingons arrive with the Nova Bomb. They're trying to destroy the asteroid. They aren't successful. The father machine loves to mess with Klingons.
Oh, it's more as I got it is he loves to eat Klingons.
Yes. And so
they taste good.
Apparently.
He tried to eat Spock.
Yeah.
Spock didn't taste good.
Well, that's that green blood of his, you know. So anyway, the Nova Bomb doesn't detonate. The father machine will be using that for propulsion purposes. Kirk says you're going to run out of energy and you're going to have to get near a star or something. And we find out that this father machine, this asteroid, is capable of drawing energy from numerous sources. Okay, well, we don't like the humans. We don't like the Vulcans. We like the Klingons. So Kirk and company are able to leave. And at the end of the book, everything is reset back the way it was, and the Enterprise goes on its merry way.
Just like episodic television.
Yes, everything is reset back to the way it was. So that's roughly what the story was. There wasn't a whole lot of substance to it. It read very much like an episode of television. The aliens, the Chitalians, were apparently a plant-based race. And the salt thing even affected... Well, I wanted to mention during the story that the humans were not welcome. Okay, they don't taste good because of the salt. And the salt was not only painful for the Chitalians, but it was also poisoning the land where they were growing food.
Again, not explained, but that would probably take more than 150 pages.
Yeah. At least it was the vehicle for the Enterprise crew to get sent away. Just get out of here. We don't want you here. You're poison. Go away.
Yeah.
So that's basically all there is to this. The Klingons don't play a huge role in this. They're there. We really don't get any cultural information or anything other than we have this new wrinkle of this Nova Bomb.
We didn't learn anything new.
Not really, no. So, you know, here we go again, all right? The entire population of the Chitalia were playthings for a supreme being known as the Father Machine, was one thing I came up with. Spock's logic to the rescue. Where have we seen that before?
Every episode of Star Trek? And I don't mean just the original series, because there's a few episodes of TNG you see that in.
Yes.
Also.
Yes. But you know what this one kind of reminded me of? It had shades of Return of the Archons.
Okay. without Kirk talking the machine into the grave.
Yeah. We have the supreme leader who has the entire population buffaloed, and they kind of do what he tells it to do. So that's kind of where it pulled me in that direction a little bit.
Well, now I got to disagree a little bit there. Is it really the supreme leader buffaloing a population that, well, he has designed and created to be exactly what he wants?
Yeah, And yeah, and that's
there is
where,
no free will.
Yeah, that's where the departure is. You don't even get a hint of this throughout until the very last,
the very end.
Last part of the story, and all of a sudden this father machine is revealed, and it, I don't know about you, but it felt like the story at the end was rushed to get to the end.
To get to the 150th page and
yes.
Ah, I'm sorry. I had a problem with the editors back then. It's less about the story and more about we need to sell some books.
Yeah. You have some concepts here that we can discuss?
We've already talked about them because Joe is a product of his upbringing. Joe has probably read Orphans of the Sky, David Gerald's memoir of working on Star Trek. Joe has seen some of the other concepts that are brought forth in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, it's tough to say. I even quote Clark here in my notes. Where does the term magicians come from? Well, Arthur C. Clarke said it. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
I looked that up. That's an exact quote. So, since Joe knows the writers of the 50s through the 70s, has read their works, has decided he's going to be, you know, a writer too.
Uh-huh.
He's just uses some of their stuff in a slightly different way. It's not a ripoff. It's just using the material in a new, in a slightly new way. And that's what we get.
Ah. So, do you know, would you think... You think perhaps, and I'm not saying this is definite or I haven't read it anywhere or something, this may have been from a rejected script for the television series, or perhaps maybe a season 4 or season 5.
11 years later?
Well, we read a story before that sat in a file cabinet for a very long time before it was brought out and fleshed out.
Okay, I don't know. To me, it seems more like let's throw a story together using some plot elements from the writings of the time and turn it into a Star Trek novel.
Okay. A money grab.
I can't see them rejecting David Gerald's script and then turn around and have Joe Haldeman write it.
Yeah. Oh, no, they wouldn't. You know what I mean? They wouldn't do that. They wouldn't do that.
So, no, I have to think it's new and on its own and unfortunately not fleshed out enough.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... I really like to have seen some more Klingon stuff going on.
Or even more science.
Yeah.
To what he's postulating this story is about.
Yeah. I, you know what? The thing is, but the father machine, one of the themes that I picked up on this was we have the father machine believing itself to be omniscient and omnipotent, all-knowing and able to do anything it wants to do. And I don't know, that kind of bothers me, especially since it never came back again.
Well, I suppose that doesn't really bother me because if you're the only thing around, you are omnipotent.
Mm-hmm.
You are omnipresent. I mean, if there's nothing else around to contradict you and reality is what you're making it, well, that's kind of the definitions of those terms.
Yeah.
If you look at a human or any animal or any plant as a machine, then the father machine can be a machine.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Otherwise, it's a plant, pure and simple. And it's the only plant. Yeah, it's an intelligent plant, and it can do things, manipulate the environment. But as such, it becomes omnipotent and omnipresent because it's the only thing there that can really come up with ideas and products.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So let's move into closing thoughts. Go ahead. Take it away.
Well, like I said, I've read Joe, you know, pretty much all my life. Forever War was published back in the 70s. And, yeah, I don't know if he's writing in prose fiction anymore, but I know he's recently submitted poetry to some of the science fiction magazines. So he's still around. He's still writing. He's one of those writers that takes a lot of time to write. Hence, there's a long gap between his novels. Maybe not as bad as George R. R. Martin, but there's a gap because he's so conscientious about what he puts down on the paper. His other stories in his own universe are more logically held together than what I'm seeing in this book, which again draws me back to, since Joe takes a long time to write and the editors want this thing now, he was being forced into some compromises. Aside from that, I'm still going to be a Joe Haldeman fan, maybe not of his Trek novels. He only wrote two. His brother only wrote one, but go Joe.
Yeah. Well, and I know I have read Joe Haldeman's work in the past. I couldn't tell you what, because it's been so long. Probably in the 70s is the last time I read something from him, which we're talking now 40 years. But I can't recall. But the impression, my memory tells me that his work is way better than this. His own work is way better than this book. And it being rushed, it definitely felt rushed, especially the last two chapters. I mean, let's get it on paper, let's print it, and let's get it into the drugstores so we can make $3.95 or whatever they cost.
Actually, my edition is $1.95.
Okay. So, yeah.
And according to, it's a first.
Yeah.
It's a first edition.
So, again.
I couldn't get a first edition of Forever Wars signed by Joe, but I got a signed copy of this.
Right. Well, that's cool. And I'll tell you what, as I said earlier, I didn't hate this story. I didn't particularly like this story. I should say I didn't hate it. I didn't love it. It was just, okay, it was a story. And I enjoy reading Star Trek stories.
I think the problem we're running into right now is that we're having trouble finding stories that are Klingon-centric, or at least have enough Klingon material in them to show us something new about Klingon culture.
Yes.
To show us something new about what Klingons do, why they do it. It's just, so yeah, we're looking at books now where Klingons are just the communists that the United States is fighting.
Yeah.
And I say that because that's actually what it was in the TV series when Gene imagined the Klingons.
Well, what we're doing is we're searching for books that have Klingons mentioned in the blurbs or whatever. And, you know.
So if you're listening to this and you know of a good book that you think we should review, please tell us. Yes. We need to find that book.
Yes. And also, what are your thoughts? You can email these to us. You can talk to us on Facebook about it or whatever.
Or more importantly, write these things down on a $20 bill and mail it to us.
That's even better. Yes.
I know. I stole that from Car Talk. Sorry.
Hey, I'll take it. But, you know, perhaps what would the thoughts be about branching out and looking at books that are focused on other non-human races? The Ferengi, the Cardassians, there's a lot of books we can look at. Yet if we branch out to the Xenolegions, so forth.
What do you, as our listener, think of that idea?
Yeah. That's, I would,
let
I
us
would,
know.
I would like to know that. So at any or rate,
in any case, drop us a line and say hi. We'd just like to know that you're actually even out there.
Yeah. Are you listening? So, So what I came up with for next time is a book called The Wounded Sky, and this one's by Diane Duane. We've read her work before. We have talked about it favorably. Klingons are mentioned in the blurb. So
she's the one that did the Romulan books that we reviewed.
Yes, the Rian Su series. So we'll go back, we'll look at that, and see what we can come up with there.
And by that, he means The Wounded Sky. He doesn't mean the Rian Su series.
Right. We've been there with the Rian Su. All right. So with that, I am Jajim.
And I am not Rian Su.
No.
Oh, wait a minute. No, I'm Jorn.
Right.
I'm
Jorn. And be sure Jorn. To join
not,
us.
Not Rian Su. Jorn.
Be sure to join us next time on Bound by Honor. Kapla.
Rian Su. Oh, Kapla.
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kurg Zantai Loon Keej. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!